Now I'm going to assume there is a downward-sloping market demand curve and show that the theory of supply doesn't work either. And the core message behind all this is that the whole idea that you can analyse markets in terms of supply and demand is invalid. But the starting point of discussion here is how realistic is the model? And one thing you'll be told by a lot of economists is that realism doesn't matter. All that matters is the model captures what happens in the real world. Now, there aren't many neoclassical economists trumpeting that theory right now because none of them saw the global financial crisis coming. It's rather an embarrassing time to be a conventional economist right now. But back in 1953, again, there's something about that year, Friedman argued that the assumptions, the realism of the assumptions of the neoclassical model do not matter. And this is something that you could do at an honors course or a PhD course at some stage in an American university, they'll drum this one into you. They tried to drum it into me in my master's course at Sydney, New South Wales, and it didn't go down all that well. So the argument Friedman was making is that, okay, look, we know that people don't really set, consciously, go out and work out what their marginal cost is and their marginal revenue or equate the two to work out profits. He's saying if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be profit maximizers. Okay. So that's the basic argument. Yeah, okay, it's unrealistic to assume that, you know, accountants do calculus, which is what would be required to actually have this done. But if they don't behave in the same sense as if they're doing the calculus, then the firm won't maximise the profits, and therefore the firm's likely to fail over time compared to others that do actually end up doing that, even if they don't know that they're doing it. And this was in a methodology paper called The Methodology of Positive Economics, written back in 1953. Now, if you think about 1953, it wasn't a time known for lots of raving, long-haired radicals bashing down the orthodoxy of economic theory. That took place in 1968 till about 73. So who the hell were they bashing back in 1953 when conservatism still ruled? What he's actually bashing were people who are going out and doing empirical research and publishing articles in the American Economic Review and elsewhere saying that, that firms don't equate marginal cost and marginal revenue, don't know what the terms mean, and when we explain what we think they mean, they reckon we're lunatics. The most important set of papers were by a guy called Eichmann, E-I-T-E-M-A-N, but there were many others, Gardner Means, quite a few researchers doing empirical work, and all of them found that no firm appeared to do what theory assumed that the firms actually do. And Milton Friedman said, well, that doesn't matter, because that's a bit like saying that you've got to imagine a billiard player can't be obeying Newton's laws because they don't know what Newton's laws are. Because if you actually hit a billion, you know, hit a billion bug, what do they call that thing? The stick? The cube. Hit it against the ball, you're applying a force to the ball which will make it move at a certain speed, giving the mass and how fast it's moving, the acceleration, the spin, everything else. And you said if you actually did apply all those equations and watch what happened in the game of expert billiards, then you could accurately predict what was going to happen by applying those equations. But we know that billiard players aren't doing that. Now, most billiard players don't do degrees in physics. But they must be doing something akin to that if they're going to sink the ball in the first place. So he said, unless they were actually doing something that was similar, then there's no way they'd be successful billiard players. And he makes the analogy to say exactly the same thing applies about the theory of the firm. It doesn't matter that the firms don't actually do consciously what we tell is profit-maximising behaviour, because if they didn't, they wouldn't maximise profits and they would therefore fail competitively against other firms that did maximise profits. They wouldn't have the same amount of money to invest, they wouldn't grow as fast, etc., etc. So saying all this stuff, even though we know people don't consciously do it, if they're not doing it, they're not going to be successful businessmen, therefore we can use it as a model of what is actually going on behind the scenes. So his argument is effectively that even though firms don't consciously equate marginal cost and marginal revenue, if they didn't do it, they wouldn't maximise profits. Now, when Friedman wrote that, It was, of course, a long time before computers were commonplace. The first computers turned up to help break the Germans' Enigma code so they could sink German submarines by knowing where they were. That was the very first set of computers. The English actually invented the first computers. And they stupidly sold the secrets to the Americans in return for the secret for the atom bomb. And frankly, I think it was a pretty bad trade by the British. Computers have made a lot more money than atom bombs have made. But anyway, these days you've all got a computer far more powerful than anything used in the Second World War, and indeed anything used 10 years ago. And we can actually test this. So I'm going to now set up the textbook market curve, market demand curve thing, and see what would happen, because what Milton Friedman said was that firms don't actually consciously do this. They've got to be playing some sort of rule of thumb. So I'm going to set up an artificial market where you've got a downward sloping market demand curve, and you've got rising marginal costs, all the stuff you see in the textbook. And I'm going to populate that with artificial firms. And all these artificial firms do is they choose an output level, and they then choose an amount they're going to vary the output by. And if they change their output level and profit rises, they continue changing output by the same amount. But if they change their output level and profit falls, they go in the opposite direction. There's no intelligence apart from saying, profit's risen, I'll keep on increasing output if that's what I was doing beforehand, or profit's fallen, I'll cut output if I was increasing it beforehand. So there's not much brain power there. But according to Milton Friedman's argument, their behaviour should converge to what we say is profit-maximising behaviour, which is equating marginal cost and marginal revenue. That sound reasonable as an exercise? Okay, here we go again. They choose an output level at random. They then choose an amount to vary that by also at random. And they vary their output. If profit rises, they keep going in the same direction. If profit falls, they go in the reverse direction. That's just about, I call them instrumentally rational, because they're doing something step by step which is sensible given the information they're working on. That's all the information they've got. They're not doing calculus. Well, let's see what happens. Do they actually behave the way neoclassical theory says they do? And if they don't behave that way, do they end up making less profits or more profits? Quite open question. So what I have is textbook supply and demand curve. We've got a linear demand curve, A minus B times Q, and I've got marginal cost for the entire market rising in a parabola, a rise, so it's a upward sloping. And I can't stand the examples in your textbooks, like Mankiw in particular, where they have a perfectly competitive lemonade stand producing 10 or 12 units of lemonade and facing rising marginal cost. I mean, I'm sorry, the usual model for perfect competition is the wheat farm, and I've never seen a wheat farm producing 10 bushels of wheat. Okay, they've gone by 10,000 maybe. So I use big numbers. A is 800, B is 1 over 10 million, D is 1 over 100 million, and E is 1 to the 10 to the over a billion. And I then get a set of realistic numbers, in a sense, for how big the market is. It's in billions of units, and a price which is in, say, maybe hundreds of cents, let's say, working in cents here. So there's my demand and supply curves for the entire market, and my marginal revenue curve. And you'll notice the prediction from the theory is that the competitive firms will produce where the green circle is, whereas the theory also predicts the monopoly will produce where the orange square is. So they'll get a higher price and a lower output out of the monopoly. So I'm going to test that, starting off with a model of a single firm, that's the monopoly, and then considering two firms and three firms and four firms. And I can use the prediction that the firms will equate marginal cost and marginal revenue at each profit level, at each industry structure, to work out what the neoclassical theory says the prediction will be. And I've got my own prediction, I'll explain that in a moment. This is the program. Has anybody in this room done computer programming? Anybody at all? A couple, very few. I recommend you learn some. There's lots of computer programmers around these days. One called Lua that you'll see actually being used in a program I'm going to give to you guys at the end of the course called QED. You can do lots of programming these days and work out what's actually happening when you use a spreadsheet and things like that. It's not a hard thing to do these days, and it's worth learning what actually goes on in a computer program. This is from the program that I do most of my work in called MathCAD, and I'll just take you through what's happening there. I start off with what's called a for loop, and that's saying for I ranging from the minimum number of firms to the maximum number of firms. So I start at 1 and go to 100. That's that first line there. And the second line says, choose an output quantity for each firm, which is randomly distributed between the prediction that I'm making for each firm and the prediction conventional theory makes for each firm. Let's say I was predicting 5 million units, and the theory is predicting 10 million units, then there's going to be, if there's 10 firms, there'll be 10 randomly chosen numbers between 5 million and 10 million, what would be the initial amount the firm decides to produce. That's that line there. Then, given that I've got a price function as well, of course, a market demand curve, so I feed the aggregate amount of being produced by all the firms in the industry into the price function and say what price applies. And having done that, I then work out an amount that each firm is going to vary its output by. And this is using the normal distribution now. So I say I'm going to choose, in this particular case, I've got each firm varying its output by an amount which has got a mean of zero, and the standard deviation is 1% of the conventional theory's prediction of what a firm will actually produce. So it means most firms are going to be changing their output either between +3 and -3% of the standard theory of the firm prediction for that market structure. Fair enough? I know it's slightly hairy. Well, let's get through step by step. Then the next bit says, okay, for 1,000 iterations, so each time step, what the program does is take the initial amount that was produced and then add to the variation for each firm. So some firms will go up and some firms will go down, and the total might rise a bit or fall a bit. Then you've got a new amount being produced on the second iteration, let's say. And then you work out what the price is on that second iteration, again feeding the new total quantity into the price function. And then having each firm can now look at the revenue it got, look at the cost it had of producing that revenue, because changing its output level changed its cost as well as the revenue level. And it works out whether its profit rose or fall. And if its profit rose, then it continues going in the same direction. If its profit falls, it reverses direction and changes its output by the same amount, but in going down when it was up beforehand or up when it was down beforehand. And then at the end of the whole thing, I return the whole history to see what the amounts being produced by each firm were for each of the iterations. So when I get to the stage of having 100 firms in the industry, I'm looking at the 1,000 different output amounts each firm produced for 100 firms, there's 10,000 numbers in that final array, and seeing how they moved as they learned what was the profit maximising level for them, using this very simple approach of just up or down in the output amounts. So that's the whole story there. And what the theory is predicting is that if the costs are comparable, and I'll talk a bit more about that particular assumption at the end, the more firms you have, the higher the output and the lower the price. That's what you've got in micro so far. Okay, remember all that? And in particular, of course, monopoly is going to be less output and a higher price than a competitive industry. And I'm going to treat 100 firms in the industry as a fairly reasonable approximation to competitive behaviour. So there's the prediction of the theory. What I'm predicting is actually the same output level, regardless of the number of firms in the industry, and the output level I'm going to predict is that one up there. I'll explain why as we go on. But here's the simulation. What I'm going to show you now is I've taken 8 or 10 firms at random, so there's 10 little dots you see over here. The industry average, my prediction for output, and the neoclassical theory's prediction. My prediction is down here, and their prediction is up there for the quantity being produced by each firm, and then the average quantity across the entire industry. So let's just let's run that. And watch what happens. The blue is the average for the entire industry. Oh dear, looks like I'm right for 100 firms. There's quite a range of output levels, as you can see, and they jiggle around like crazy. But the output being produced converges to the prediction I made and not to the neoclassical theory. What's going wrong? You get the same thing when I do in terms of, let's look at profit now, because again, the theory said that the firms are going to make a better profit if they equate marginal cost to marginal revenue. Now, I've shown whatever they're doing, that's not what they're doing. So the question of what happened to their profit levels. Well, here again, notice my profit prediction is much higher than their classical predictions. I'm actually predicting I'll make more profit by not obeying the neoclassical rule. So what happens to the profit level? Are they making more profit or less profit? Well, they're making more profit. Some are making as much as the neoclassical. This poor bugger's losing a fortune down here. They're not really wins, as you can see. It's not that there's they're not behaving in some sort of collusive fashion at all. A huge range of behaviours there. But the average is what I predicted, not what the neoclassical theory predicted. So, not only do they not do what neoclassical theory predicts, they make a higher profit. There's something rather wrong with the theory here. What might it be? So they don't behave the way Neil Milton said they would. They don't equate marginal cost and marginal revenue. And they make a higher profit by not doing what Milton says will give you the higher profit. So they're hitting the ball at bullseye, in effect. Milton's missing it by a large margin. So what's wrong? And notice also there's no difference between a competitive industry and a monopoly. There's the theory, as I've said, and there's the actual outcome. That's what the theory predicts will be done by the competitive market. That's what I'm predicting, and it pretty much overlaps with the monopoly case. So you don't have the neoclassical outcome in any sense. The number of firms has no impact on the amount of output. And this is again showing that this is now looking at the entire 100 simulations. And the horizontal line down the bottom, the blue one, is my prediction of the amount to be produced by the industry given the number of firms in the industry. The red line is the neoclassical prediction, starting at the same level for a monopoly, but rising up to pretty much twice the output level. The black line with the dots on it are the actual results of a particular simulation run in that program. I'd get a different result every time because it's a random number that seeds the whole thing, but I still get one which converges around my prediction, not around the neoclassical. And of course the profit's the same story. I'm predicting a higher profit. Neoclassical predicts a very high profit for the first firm, but falling levels over time. The prediction is supposed to be what I'm saying going to happen rather than neoclassical theory.
How did you come up with your predictions?
I'll show you. I'm getting there. And there's no collusion. This is, you saw how much those output levels were jiggling around in the previous illustration. Well, this is following three firms at random plus the average for the entire industry over the 1,000 iterations that are in the simulation for. And you can see that there's three very different behaviours there. Very different to the aggregates. And the three I've chosen are not the normal. But the average is converging down, the black bouncy line, at the average for the entire industry, converging down over time to my prediction, and as a result, getting a higher profit. So what's going wrong? Well, first off, equating marginal cost and marginal revenue does not maximise profits. That's provably mathematically false. And I'll take you through the proof in a moment. And the demand curve for an individual firm can't be horizontal, according to the assumptions of neoclassical theory. So let's take a look at why that is the case. Why can't they'll start with why the demand curve for the single firm can't be horizontal, as you've been taught so often it is. First of all, remember the theory starts by saying that firms are atomistic. Have you heard that expression before? It was more popular back when I was a student because it was closer to the nuclear age in some ways. They say they're price takers. You've heard that expression, haven't you? Firms are price takers. Well, that means that firms accept whatever the market gives them. And we know the market price slopes downwards. Any increase in quantity will reduce the market price. So if an individual firm changes its output level without considering what other firms do, without reacting to what other firms might do, market output's going to rise and price is going to fall. Rather than being price takers being an explanation for why prices are horizontal for the single firm, it's an explanation for why price will fall for the single firm. Not much, but it will still fall. And the slope of the demand curve facing the individual firm is exactly the same as the slope of the market demand curve. Now, you've been shown illustrations that are very, very different to that, but I'm going to show you some that show it's very, very true. And again, ironically, this one wasn't done in the year I was born. At this stage, I was four, about to go into primary school or kindergarten. But this has been known since 1957. And the person who proved it was anything but a raving radical. This is Joe Stigler, who is one of the most conservative defenders of neoclassical theory. And the journal he's writing in is actually a highly conservative journal too, even though it's got the name Political Economy. It's one of the most conservative journals in America. It's just an old-fashioned name. And he's writing the lead article, you notice on pages 1 to 17, a commissioned article, on perfect competition, historically contemplated. That's the journal. And then a particular point, footnote 31, in this article. That's why I want you to read the original. So you might necessarily see it there, but this is where you find the real information. You've got to read the original, not the textbooks. He goes through what happens. How do you expand the marginal revenue function for an individual firm? So he's got an expression here where he's saying the change in total revenue given for the IT firm, given a change in its output, is this expression here. And notice he's applied the chain rule. He said Q is total sales and DQ DQI equals 1. Now what he's saying there is this atomism assumption that a single firm changes its output and the other firms don't react, then output will change by, the industry will change by the same amount that the firm changes output, therefore DQ, DQI is 1. And applying the chain rule, he says you can now describe the marginal revenue for the individual firm as being market price plus the firm's output times the slope of the market demand curve multiplied by something else which is equal to 1. So showing you can legitimately replace the slope of the individual firm's demand curve with the market demand curve under the assumptions of perfect competition. So it's a leading article, a lead journal, and a leading neoclassical making that case. And the guy actually spent a lot of his time demolishing people who are trying to argue against neoclassical theory. Now, what's the graphical intuition there? Because most of the time you've been taught to think in terms of graphs. Well, it simply is that if you have a market demand curve that slopes down at a particular rate, any small segment of it slopes down with the same slope. So we imagine having a large market demand curve here, and you have there's Q for the market, and there's the price, and there's a larger output where all the firms vary their outputs, you know, going up, and there's this lower price. That slope is delta P over delta Q, big delta over little over big delta P over big delta Q. But if we consider a single firm inside that with its tiny amount of output, and it varies it by a tiny amount, little delta Q, then the price is going to fall by that little delta as well. It'll be the same slope. So that little delta P delta Q is going to be the same as the big delta P delta Q. And if you act as if you have no impact on the price, you're being irrational. Because, again, think about it for the ith firm. That dotted line there is a constant price. This down sloping line says, let's imagine the firm is producing nothing to begin with, and therefore the price it applies is P of Q, where Q is the output without that firm producing anything. Then if the firm produces QI, we've got a new price, which is the function of P of Q plus QI, out there somewhere. And since we have a downward sloping market demand curve, we know that P of Q plus QI will be less than P of Q. It's rational to expect yourself to have an impact on the price. Now, it might be really, really small, but it's still going to be a difference in price. And this is, if you notice, if anybody's had a look at my Debunking Economics, and if you're finding this part of the course difficult, there are copies of Debunking Economics in the library. There may be some in the bookshops. I explain it more carefully, more slowly, verbally there. But the basic mistake neoclassical economists have done is mistaken an infinitesimal amount with zero. And that's the biggest mistake you can make in calculus. So rather than applying calculus, they've made a mistake in it. Yeah?
Again, my question, maybe the same. There is zero accounting profit there. Why firm would increase the quantity of producing by knowing that price will go down, and he will lose money?
Well, they will make an accounting profit. My firms are making an accounting profit.
But this is if it is perfectly
competitive. Oh, yeah.
There is no accounting profit there, and the firm will increase the
There can be if they put the marginal cost line above the average cost.
But margin is really perfectly competitive.
That's an equilibrium.
Equilibrium, yeah. Every firm.
I know, if you get into equilibrium, but again, what I'm trying to trash is the entire idea that you should analyse an economy as if it's in equilibrium to begin with. So it's part of, I agree with you, if you're in equilibrium, then there's no accounting profit, and it's all, why bother? But in fact, they try to talk about it being out of equilibrium, so there's an accounting profit being made, and therefore the firm will reduce its output. Okay, so that's, they're trying to give you a dynamic story with a static model, which is impossible. So, you've all been shown lots of textbook examples where there's a horizontal demand curve, haven't you? But how do you do it? How do you manage to take a down sloping line and make it horizontal? It's simple. You apply magic. The magic is simply that you take a downward sloping line, which is the market demand curve, and you zoom in on one axis, but you don't zoom in on the other. And do it often enough, you'll flatten the line. I'll show you how. Here we have a downward sloping line. What I'm doing with the program is grabbing that horizontal slice you can see with the dotted lines here, grabbing that slice and zooming in on that bit. So I'm taking the entire range for price for the market between zero and $1,000 per unit. But I'm only taking a small slice of the quantity. So I do that, zoom in there, and what the program gives me is this. Hey, line's a bit flatter. But it's still not perfectly flat, so let's repeat the magic. Do it again. Bing! Getting close, but some student might notice that's not horizontal, so we better keep on going. Ah, there we go, that'll fool. I'm not saying they do this consciously. They're not even aware they're doing it. Again, it's a case of being inculcated into a false way of thinking so thoroughly that you don't realise you're even being false. But what happens when you zoom in on both the horizontal and the vertical axis? Well, here I'm going to do that. And notice I'm taking a square around the monopoly equilibrium price level there. It's not an even square, I'm just taking one that fits the axes mark that have been there, but I'm going to keep on taking a square each time rather than a vertical slice. So I do that and zoom in. Hey, downward sloping line. Do it again. Another downward sloping line. Do it again. Another downward sloping line. Well, of course, what I'm doing each time I do that, I'm drilling down to a scale which makes sense to the individual firm. Because the individual firm is going to vary its output by this small amount here and have a small impact there. But it'll still damn well see what the impact is. That's a third level of magnification. I'm still getting a downward sloping line. Magic is really a sleight of hand. And I've shown you what the sleight of hand is in that particular illustration. That's four levels, still downward sloping. Now what about some of the many comebacks I get to this argument? Can't you just assume price-taking behaviour? Sure you can assume that, so long as you're willing to model firms as being irrational non-profit maximisers. If you're willing to do that, sure. Let's have a theory of irrational behaviour in economics. That'll restore the theory. But they try to tell you that rational behaviour is consistent with profit maximising, which is also welfare maximising. Now again, the same argument. If you have a downward sloping curve, then no matter how small that downward slope is, it's rational to believe it slopes downwards. It's irrational to believe otherwise. And if we're talking about rational behaviour, we can't get the neoclassical result. I can throw in some irrationality into my model, and funnily enough, with a certain level of irrational behaviour by firms, I get the neoclassical result. If 25% of the firms are irrational, I get the neoclassical result. Or if I have a large degree of variation, so it's so confusing, all you can work out is what you're doing, then I get the neoclassical result. There's various ways I can fudge it. It's all irrelevant. None of this has any real relevance at all to real firms. So we have marginal revenue being less than price. The demand curve can't be horizontal. See, you've been taught a fallacy for the last 40 years. And by the way, I didn't realise it was a fallacy until about 8-9 years ago. It takes a while to realise this stuff. Everybody can be brainwashed into believing this stuff. Now, some people, of course, knew that it was wrong. I didn't know Stigler's article until after I wrote Debunking Economics. So how did Stigler put that forward and still defend the theory? Well, he said that there's a way we can rework the terms to justify the argument that marginal revenue will converge to price over as the number of firms in the industry rises. This is what he went through. We start off in this expression, and notice I've done the substitution straight away that the marginal revenue for the ith firm is price plus QI times the slope of the market demand curve. So we're starting from the point that Stigler proved. Then he says, let's introduce P over P and Q over Q. Multiply one side by that term, therefore we don't change anything. So I've now got this expression. And I then introduce QI as being the output of the total industry divided by the number of firms in the industry. So I can now replace that Q over N. I've now got Q over N there for QI. Okay? Shuffle the P's and Q's around. And the second half of the expression now becomes P times 1 over N times Q over P. So I've now got marginal revenue for the ith firm is price plus price times 1 over N times Q over P times DP DQ. Now that last bit of the expression there, Q over P DP DQ, is 1 over the market elasticity of demand. All this is correct. No mistakes here. So I can now rewrite the expression again and say that the marginal revenue for the ith firm is price plus price divided by N times the market elasticity of demand. And Stigler concludes triumphantly, this last term goes to zero as N goes to infinity. So the more firms there are, the more that last term is going to be divided by a large number for N, and therefore marginal revenue for the firm will converge to market price. So he's restored the theory. And that's all true. The problem is, as I mentioned earlier, equating marginal revenue and marginal cost does not maximise profits. And I want to take you through a proof of that. This gets hairy. If you found the last lecture a bit complicated, you'll find this about even more complicated. I'm not expecting you to remember or regurgitate this stuff to me. We may ask a question about the actual conclusions in a multiple choice exam at some stage, so don't fall asleep just yet. But I don't expect you to regurgitate the mathematics at me. If you do and you understand it or you find something else in there, that'd be great. HD material. But you don't have to understand this stuff and reproduce it in an exam. But here we go. I'm going to show you why the theory is wrong about maximising profits by assuming that all the firms follow the advice of neoclassical theory. So they do throw the dart the way Milton Friedman tells them to throw the dart. And that means for each firm, they're equating their marginal cost and their marginal revenue. So if there are N firms in the industry and I add up the difference between marginal revenue and marginal cost for each firm, I'll get zero. Okay? So I'm starting from that point, expanding it out and seeing what the overall aggregate result is. Because if each firm is maximising its profits, then I should find the aggregate level involves nobody making a loss. But I'm going to show you, a bit like proof by contradiction earlier, that somebody must be making a loss. Therefore, the formula itself is wrong at the individual level. So let's take that bit there. That's DPDQI, as Stigler has shown us. I can substitute that with the market demand curve. Now, of course, because most economists don't realise that, they think that's zero, and they then wipe that term out of their thinking. That's the first mistake they make when they try to think this through. That is N copies of marginal cost for the entire industry, because marginal cost of the output Q, little q for the individual firm, when we aggregate, it's going to be the same as marginal cost for the total output of the whole industry. And there's P, and I've got something P behind a summation sign between 1 to N, so I'm going to have N copies of P there. So I can now expand this whole thing and take the N times P out the front of the summation sign, and now that N times P plus the sum over N of QI multiplied by the slope of the market demand curve minus N copies of marginal cost. Now that's the total output of the industry, that's Q. That is N copies of marginal cost. So doing all that, I've now got a new expression, N times P plus Q times the P to Q minus N times marginal cost. All that's equal to zero, by the way. I haven't swapped anything from one side of the equal sign to the other yet. That's N copies of P. I'm going to take one of those P's out. Again, doing a bit of the shuffling like Stigler did beforehand. And I'm going to take one of the N marginal costs out as well, and I'm going to move those to the other side of the equal sign in a moment. So that's still all equal to zero. So now I'm going to take that marginal cost and the margin, by taking out the P, I've now got marginal revenue at the industry level, not the individual firm, the industry level. So I'm now going to take the marginal revenue and marginal cost across to the other side of the equals sign. And what I get is this expression. Now what I'm showing is, at the aggregate level, marginal revenue is less than marginal cost. Which means at the aggregate level, there are losses being made. But we've started from the assumption that all firms are making maximum profits. So the theory's got to be wrong about that being a maximising profit output, a profit maximising output level for the individual firm. There's an aggregation error, which is so common in their classical theory. All the way through, they're making aggregation errors, and this is just like I've shown you one in the theory of the demand curve beforehand, here's one in the theory of the supply curve. And the reason for that is simple. What they describe as marginal revenue for the individual firm is not total marginal revenue. Because the revenue for the single firm depends upon what other firms do. Now that's even when you don't know what other firms do, and even when you can't control it, and even when you don't react to it, it's still the case that what other firms do affects the revenue you get. So your marginal revenue is not a function of your individual behaviour, it's a function of what the entire industry does. That's part of the definition of being in an industry. So what you need to do is to work out the total differential, which is the expression I've shown you there. And that bit there is how much your revenue changes given what other firms do. Now, neoclassical theory would argue that's what they ignore, and they'd also tend to argue that you can't work it out. But firms can work that out.
So you said,
before
you mentioned that an infinitesimally small amount can never be equated to zero, so why are we working with zeros now?
Pardon?
Before you mentioned that an infinitesimally small amount can never be equated to zero,
yeah.
So why are we assuming zero?
I'm saying neoclassicals do that, not me. That's the error they make. Well, they either equate it to zero or they think firms can't know it. So that's actually the profit maximising output level. So what they're ignoring, they're saying, oh, that's zero. They're wrong. Okay. So that formula, to show you how I got that, that's saying if you actually want to make, if the neoclassical assumptions are correct about a downward sloping market demand curve, an upward sloping marginal cost, or even constant marginal cost, then the way the firm actually maximises profits is not by setting marginal cost equal to marginal revenue, but making the gap between marginal revenue and marginal cost n minus 1 over n, well, that's the number of firms in the industry, times the gap between price and marginal cost. So you actually profit maximise by not making the point of intersection. And that the gap you allow allows what other firms do. Now, to work that out, what you can do is say, well, I've now shown you what this sum is equal to. So I then take the part of that expression on the other side of the equals sign. I now know that's equal to aggregate marginal revenue and marginal cost. And for total industry output to be profit maximising, those two have to be equal to each other. That's got to be zero. And I can now take that expression n minus 1 times P and n minus 1 times marginal cost inside the summation sign for a single firm. And what I get is this expression. That's the way of maximising profits. Now that's a bit of a cheat. Neoclassical economists would think I'm talking about collusive behaviour there because I've said let's make aggregate profit as high as it can be. And that sounds like collusive behaviour. But there's another way to derive it which it totally ignores what other firms do. And I'll show you that in a moment. But to put a visual on this, what's actually happening is if you follow neoclassical theory, it's like saying the best way to get across a river to your objective is to row directly across it, ignoring the current, because you can't control the current. Of course, you can't control the current, but you'd be an idiot to try to row to where you want to go without taking it into account. So what I'm giving is a formula that does take that into account, even if you can't control it. And of course, there's a second proof, which I'll show you in a moment. Well, let's just imagine you have a businessman. I love the fact this illustration looks like Kerry Packer. And believe me, Kerry behaved that way. I knew some of his employees and I met him once, strangely enough, and I took a bunch of journalists to China, and one of them is an employee of Kerry Packer. And he said, when he gets back to Sydney, he said, Kerry will bump into me in the corridors of Consolidated Press and say, how was China? He said, I'll answer, oh, it was interesting, Kerry. And Kerry will say next, can I make a buck out of it? And he says, if I say no, he'll say, oh, okay, and he'll walk down the corridor and leave me alone. If I say yes, he'll drill me against the wall and I won't move for 3 hours. I never actually asked him whether he said yes or no. I should one of these days and find out. Anyway, imagine Kerry Packer asking you this question. Well, being trained in neoclassical economics, you'd say, oh, that's simple. You just equate marginal cost and marginal revenue. Bob's your uncle. Well, Kerry's your uncle, which is even worse. Gives it to a mathematician. He said, well, that's an interesting problem. What I have to do is equate the total differential of profit to zero and go through and solve that mathematical problem. Now, for those who want to actually exercise their brains, if you click on that little green bar down the bottom, it'll take you to the part where I take you through that proof. It's too complicated for this class, but it's there, and you can check and see how it's done. So do take a look if you're curious. But to finally sum up what we get to with this Marshallian theory, the theory's incoherent. One of the major conclusions they draw is that monopoly is worse than competitive firms. And that may well be true in the real world. It may well be true that a firm like Microsoft is a damn sight worse than having lots of people producing in small firms, or that, you know, free software would give us a better software than we get out of one large company producing the stuff. Or it may be that competition would lead to greater innovation or less. There's quite a few possibilities there. But the whole idea you can reduce it just to saying big firms bad, small firms good, is based on mathematical fallacies. And another thing that's assumed as well, I haven't gone into the detail here, I've done that in a few of my academic papers you can find on my blog, but remember again, you assume the same marginal cost curve applies whether you're talking about a single monopoly or lots and lots of competitive firms. Now, in fact, the condition under which that applies and applies universally is that marginal cost is constant and the same for all firms. I proved that in one of the papers. So the only way you can get that curve coinciding is either that that's true, in which case there's no difference in cost at all and the output will be, according to my theory, exactly the same at what they call the monopoly level, or by sheer coincidence, when you add up the cost curves of lots of small firms, they coincide with the large firms' costs, and that requires a fluke of nature that the marginal cost depends upon the number of firms in the industry, which is nonsense because marginal cost is supposed to be a function of each individual firm's output level. So the whole theory falls apart. Rational profit-maximising behaviour is not compatible with welfare maximisation. What you're told is a welfare loss due to monopoly is, even if the theory accurately describes reality, which it doesn't, it's a result simply of competition. And the whole idea of general equilibrium analysis is wrong as well. Most general equilibrium analysis presumes competitive firms and price equals marginal cost. That's assuming profit minimising behaviour, virtually. Not quite minimising, but close. So the theories are shambles. And in particular, what you're told is a deadweight loss of monopoly is actually effectively a deadweight loss of profit maximisation. And as a punchline, the supply curve doesn't exist. Okay, I showed you before the demand curve doesn't have the shape of a downward sloping market demand curve. But the real trouble here is this whole idea that there's a supply curve depends upon price equal marginal cost behaviour by firms, because this is taking Mantis' illustration and playing with it a bit. Here's the idea that price equals marginal cost equals average revenue. These are new slides, by the way, so you can download them from the view site shortly. And there's rising marginal cost. And that's supposed to be the output level that the firm produces. Okay? And there's a second lower level of price and a lower level of output and a higher one. You only get the marginal cost curve being the supply curve if the firms are setting price equal to marginal cost. Now, if they're not, you get the monopoly type situation. And this is what can happen. There's your aggregate marginal cost curve. I'm assuming you can do that, and I've already argued you can't in general, but anyway, let's let me get away with it for a while. There's one demand curve, and there's the marginal revenue curve that goes with it at the market level, and as I've shown you, that's going to be the output level on the price. If we then consider a different demand curve with a different slope, then I'm going to get a different point of intersection for marginal revenue and marginal cost at the aggregate level. That's going to be the market output level. And if I try to derive what the curve looks like, that's going to be my supply curve. Slight problem, sloping in the wrong way. Okay? In other words, once you don't have price equal to marginal cost behavior, you can't derive a supply curve at all, independent of the demand curve. Whereas for the theory to work, you must be able to do that. So the whole idea of supply and demand analysis goes out the window. And that's really why neoclassical economists are so obsessed with perfect competition. There is another way to get their result. It's bringing what they call Korno-Nash equilibrium. That has a great problem. That's mathematically correct. That actually works. The trouble is it only works if you only do it once. Once you repeat the game more than once, what they call the Korno-Nash equilibrium is no longer the equilibrium. And they haven't been able to get around that one, so they should have, if they're being honest, thrown Marshall out and at least tried Korno and shoved that down your throats in first year. But it's too complicated to teach, and in fact it doesn't work if there's more than one round, when of course competition involved being permanently in the industry or regular industry. So that's a deadweight loss due to profit maximisation. It's not due to competition at all. And in fact, again on the whole idea, if you actually have lower costs for a monopoly than a competitive firm, which is quite feasible, then a monopoly on this argument will be preferable. And in fact, the theory ends up recommending, bizarrely enough, monopoly, which will get lower prices out of it, once you correct it for that mistake. Now, the reason there is simple, and there's a great illustration in a paper in a journal I contributed a chapter to on this topic by an expert on the gas industry. And she pointed out that if you have a gas field, one of the essential elements in the gas field is how large is the pipe taking the gas from the field to the city. Now, if you have lots of competitors doing it, they're going to have lots of small pipes. If you have one big firm doing it, it's going to have one big pipe. Now, the amount of pressure you need to drive the oil, the gas along the pipe is a function of the diameter. And the larger the diameter of the pipe, the less pressure you need to move this equivalent volume of gas. So the monopoly, the large firm, will have a lower marginal cost. And therefore, if you want to get cheap gas, go for a monopoly supplier of gas, not a competitive supplier, on the basis of marginal cost. So if you're going to attack monopoly, you have to attack it on something other than the basis of costs being lower because of this necessary impact of size on cost of production and profitable behaviour. So here we are back to the question of what the hell is rational? Because we had a theory that starts with the definition of rational behaviour that we found was empirically false and is simply impossible for people to behave that way. It has problems of what are called emergent properties. This is something you'll hear talked about in more advanced areas of science and economics. Talk about what they call emergent properties, saying that if you have a certain simple level of behaviour and you aggregate above that, you don't get the aggregate behaviour being simply the sum of what happens at the simple level. And it's a very hard thing for people to grasp. Well, I've actually shown you two illustrations of it in this paper. If you have a whole lot of agents who've all got downward sloping demand curves, aggregate, you get a wobbly line. Okay? So what happens at the individual level, when you aggregate, becomes something different. And that's the idea of emergent properties at a high level of aggregation. And it's something which economics should take seriously and develop a theory that works at that level, but they haven't done it, and their practicals haven't. So that's one end, and you ignore the supply theory as well. I don't think that's rational. I think the economic theory that prided itself on defining the word rational and talking rational when the cows come home is actually seriously irrational. So whatever rationality is not what economists call it. We need a definition of rational behaviour that makes sense. And computational issues, of course, turn up there as well, as I showed you last week. So the definition of rational is wide open. Now, what I'm going to do next week is show that it applies to how economists have used the word rational in talking about finance markets. And you'll see the theory there is irrational as well. But the bad news is it isn't just the neoclassical economists who are irrational about it. Even some of the behavioural economists have got it wrong in how they treat what's called rational behaviour. Now, I know this is a pretty heavy trashing of theory I'm doing here, and disillusioning as well as anything else. In the next few weeks, after I've been through this stuff, I'll start building an alternative approach to economics, which is rather more realistic and, I hope, rather more exciting. So if I'm depressing you all with this stuff, I hope to cheer you up in later weeks. But that's it for today. Any questions? I'll just stop at that point there, I think.
Your arguments to this take much more convincing than what they were 2 years ago.
I've worked on a lot.
Yeah. For a long time ago, I always just accepted the Marxist idea that society tends to monopoly.
That's right. You did history of economic thought before, didn't you? Yeah, so this, I have more time here than I got on that particular course to pull the arguments apart too. So, and there's lots of academic papers behind. When did you do the course with me, 2 years ago?
I did financial economics before.
Yeah, that'd be several years ago. That chance to find the eye. I was going to turn the camera off. Oh, didn't you?
Yeah.
I'll let you get away with it for the first one.
Yeah.
See you next time, okay?
Yeah.
Honest problems are allowed.
Yeah.
You're welcome. We will show you in the next few lectures. We'll get there, believe me. Okay.
Yeah. Have you the extra 1 hour class?
If people want to stay for a discussion, it's just a general. Just a quick reminder to everybody. There's no way I can run tutorials to this many people, but I'm happy to stay and chat. Anybody wants to talk in a structured discussion? We did that last year quite successfully, but it was a much better room than this. So if you want to stay and have a chat in general, hang around for a while and we'll talk away. But if you want to go as well, that's also equally all right. Okay? Yeah.
Hi. I just transferred into this class. I was doing superannuation.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but this seems far more interesting than that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, what happens in regards to some work?
All you've missed is one set of readers. And I'll copy an email, and I'll see if you want to read. You'll be up on the class register, and I'll give you your answer.
Not a problem. And the next one is due in 4 days?
It starts, the next one becomes available now to you for, I think, a week after this. You've got at least 1 week to get it done, 2 weeks.
So what I'll do is I'll do the meeting.